Welcome to Command Control Power, a weekly podcast hosted by three certified members of the Apple Consultants Network, drawing from over 30 years combined experience. We talk shop, interview vendors and colleagues, and share what we've learned while operating our technology consulting practices. This is Joe Saponari of CIMAC, and my two co-hosts are Sam Valencia of the HCS Technology Group and Jerry Zygmunt of MacWorks. We are live at commandcontrolpower.com, the first Tuesday of every month, where new episodes are posted weekly. Thanks for listening.
I recently got a call from a client looking for support. They had a MacBook Air, and they had said that they were in the process of upgrading their operating system. And what they think happened was that the hard drive just completely filled. They brought it to the Apple Store, and the Apple Store said the Mac was too old and they couldn't support it, and would I be happy to take a look at it? So I said, sure, slam dunk here. Put it in target disk mode. We pull maybe some non-essential files off of it, and we get the MacBook Air to boot. We're kind of off and running and just see where we land. Maybe we have to use Disk Warrior or different tools like that. So I show up at the client site. I haven't seen one of these in a long time. I own one myself. I walked in the door, and there sitting on the table was indeed a MacBook Air with the little trap door on the left-hand side for the power cord.
Nice.
So I said, wow. And what operating system were you running? He said he was running El Capitan, and he was trying to put on Sierra. And I'm like, oh, my God. I said, I don't even think it's actually capable. And somewhere along the way, I had in the back of my mind that a lot of those machines were 32-bit, and they couldn't run 64-bit Sierra and Yosemite, for that matter, and El Cap, right?
The original MacBook Air, which it was released in January 2008, I remember when I was there at Macworld when it was released, it was my first Intel Mac, tops out at 10.7, 10.75. So that's how old that one is. And then there was a late 2008 revision, which will go as late as 10.11.6. So El Cap is where those ended.
Gotcha. So that's what he had. And I didn't really know whether it was a first gen or a second gen. I was thinking it was a first gen, and I was very surprised that he was running 10.11. This was indeed a Gen 2. I couldn't really do much with it. I tried to boot it. I tried to use my Disk Warrior key, and it seemed like the drive was completely filled to capacity. And I just had no way to reach the drive, and I couldn't take it apart because I didn't have an enclosure. Those have those iPod drives in them, the 1.8.
They're like ZIF connectors, right? The very first MacBook Air had a capital ZIF, ZIF connector. The second rev and third rev were maybe a different connector, but still I want to say a parallel ATA drive, not a SATA drive.
You are so smart, Joe Saponari.
Oh, believe me, you have no idea how
I'm writing this down.
On this, I had a first gen MacBook Air with a 4200 RPM parallel ATA drive, which sucked. That drive was the bottleneck of the whole system, and I replaced it with an SSD. Believe it or not, I found an SSD that was a parallel ATA SSD, like an IDE drive, in the 1.8-inch form factor, no less, and I had nothing but trouble with that, and that just was like, okay, that's a write-off. That machine just did not survive the long haul. So anyway, that's why I know this stuff, because I dived in pretty deep on that.
Well, evidently, I think at the time, Toshiba was the first people to make these, but then Hitachi ended up making them in Seagate and Samsung, and that form factor became more popular. So I took the MacBook Air apart, and I removed the drive. What I found out was that the 1.8s in the first gen Rev had a 40-pin ZIF connector, which, when you look at it, it's just a ribbon cable on one side. And the newer ones, the Gen 2s, had a 24-pin. So I ordered up the wrong case. This 40-pin came in. We couldn't get it to run. Came back to the client, ordered up another one. I think the enclosures were like $12 on Amazon. We'll put them into show notes. Connected it. I hooked it up to my Mac to see if I could actually get the drive to spin up. The drive just would not spin up at all. It sounded like there was current, because once in a while you could hear the drive make a little chirp noise, but that was it. And I told him that in all likelihood the drive is seized. And he said, well, what about putting it in the freezer? I said, you know, I've been doing this a long time. It's like a real goofy thing. And I know there's lots of people online that write about, oh, they put the drive in the freezer. You know, the best we could do here is for you to send this out to Drive Savers. It's going to be a little bit costly. The guy was local. He was a really nice guy, and he was really hustling, and he had a cute little daughter that he had picked up from school. And I just really couldn't charge him because, you know, let me give you a little bit of money. I said, nah, forget it. You know, and he still slipped me some cash and I left. Well, a couple days later, the phone rings and he said, I'd like you to come over. I got the drive working.
What?
And I said, you're kidding me. how did you get the drive to work? You know, I'm the expert, right?
Right.
And he goes, I put it in the freezer.
Oh, come on.
I was going to say, man, why didn't you at least give it a shot?
I know, right. Exactly. I've had it work once, actually.
Yeah, I have too.
And, you know, I explained to him, you know, when he first asked about it, I said, well, you know, the reason why this theoretically sometimes works is that the metal contracts when it's exposed to the extreme cold. And sometimes that's enough to just free up the platter on the drive itself. You know, in my experience, this is not the way to get your data. So I came back over. We were able to copy all his data to an external drive. He had gone out and bought a brand new MacBook Air, and we put all his stuff back on. And the guy was like thrilled to death.
Did you give him a few bucks at the end?
I did.
You pay him. Oh, man.
But it was just the weirdest thing, you know, because I mean, I can't even tell you the last time I saw one of these other than the one that I have in my basement. And the one I have in my basement is a first gen and it's got a solid state in it.
So you ordered it with a solid, that was like $1,000 upgrade or something.
No. I never paid for this. I got this from a client.
Okay.
Who had dropped it, cracked the screen. I had repaired the whole top assembly. It wasn't very expensive. I got the parts used and got the thing working again. So it was fun for a little while.
I mean, you know, your advice was right. Like if the guy says, you know, hey, let's put it in the freezer. It's well, I can't really in good faith recommend that unless you're ready to just say, I don't care if I get the data back. Like the proper solution is let's send it to a data recovery specialist if we want to like any hope of getting our data back. The freezer thing is like a last ditch, right? I mean, that's like, you know, you're throwing caution to the wind a little bit because you've put it in the freezer, you could do more damage. You know,
you guys, just throw caution to the wind, man. Chuck it in the freezer. You're good.
Yeah, if you're sitting in the cheap seats, you throw the stuff in the freezer. But, you know, if you're in the front row for the Jennifer Lopez concert, you go to DriveSavers.
I thought you were going to say Beyonce, but Jennifer Lopez is close enough.
You know, and that's really interesting, too. That brings up a very good point. I recently had an experience where a client had a house fire. Some parts of the house were exposed to extreme heat, and they had a Drobo. In the computer area, most of the data devices were exposed to smoke, maybe 100 degree temperatures, but nothing higher than that. So some of the labeling on some of the devices was discolored. It was one of those issues where I had to decide whether I was going to try to get a new Drobo enclosure and see if I could fire up this RAID, or because it is an insurance claim, what is acting in the client's best interest? Hmm. Is it for you to try to do this and try to build a client, or is it best to just simply pass it on to DriveSavers when you're in a situation like that, where you're the trusted source who's being brought in to evaluate the equipment and it's going through an insurance company anyway?
Yeah, it's a good question because the budget is essentially, it's not that it's unlimited, but like because it's going through the insurance company, you know, it costs what it costs, right? So, you know, I mean, I guess the way I would spin it there is I can try and maybe I can get it back easier and at less cost and so on. But there's always a risk that any attempt at data recovery could make it less recoverable, right? Could do more damage, you know, as long as we're trying to spin up the drive, if it's mechanically failed in some way, or there's little particles of smoke inside there or whatever that are going to be smashing into the platters and destroying data. There's always a chance you make things worse, right? Isn't that fair to say?
That was my call on that.
I took your story. Sorry, Jerry.
No. That was great. So that's what I decided to do. I said, well, listen, we'll pull the drives from the Drobo. We'll send them off to DriveSavers, and that's where we'll start. Because the majority of their data was on there. I just pulled the drives from the other devices, and I have them stored in some Ziploc bags in my office, and we'll deal with them as things unfold and progress.
In a situation like that, too, I mean, would you be concerned legally about, would you have them sign, you know, one of your one-page documents to make sure that if anything were to go sideways, that they wouldn't blame you personally?
Possibly. I mean, it would all depend on the client. I mean, I had a background with this client before, and they brought us in as the trusted source. So you already have a certain amount of credibility established with them because they're relying on you to make the right decision. It's just DriveSavers. But you're right. Probably would think hard about that if, in fact, they said, no, you know, we'd like to maybe not put this through the insurance company and we'd simply like you to try to recover it. I think it might be a good idea for them to just sign off on it.
Yeah, it becomes just a scary situation if something were to go bad. You make the data, like Joe was saying, irrecoverable, and then you're in a worse position than you were before. Anytime it comes to data recovery, I do get a little bit nervous about those types of situations at times, especially if there's a lack of backup. And I think probably you guys have done a lot more of that than I have. At least I know Joe has. You guys will set up shop on your bench and kind of do your thing. It is a bit of a concern anytime you're messing with data and there's no other copy of that information.
For sure. Yeah, we usually preface it that we have a very good track record of recovering data, and it's usually 99% of the time it's from drives that don't have a mechanical failure, or at least not a failure where it's not mounting and making a sound. It might be slow to mount, it might be, you know, kind of on its last leg, so to speak, but usually we can obviously get it to spin up or we can't work on it. If it's making any kind of sound, we'll stop right there. But we'll tell the client that we're very likely to be able to get the data back in our experience. There is a chance that any effort we make whatsoever could, you know, result in it being less recoverable. If you really need the data back and you want to go to the next level of professional data recovery company, you know, on the order of, it's like over $2,000, I think, if you quote DriveSavers, it's around $1,000 for most options that are out there. If you want it back at any cost, no matter what, then it's probably best for us not to try, because there is a chance we might make it worse. So we always preface it with that. Truth be told, I mean, most of the time it doesn't have to go to DriveSavers. It's usually not a mechanical failure, at least to that extent.
I was recently at a client. They had told me that they lost a file. They deleted it by mistake. So they asked me to come in and retrieve it from backup. A couple of our clients have the solution Brew by Talus Group, which is a great solution. I mean, it backs up to a tape carousel and stuff, but it's also a little bit, I don't know, I don't use it enough to be well-versed in it, so I have a tough time navigating through it. I get the file he's looking for, the relative date and time, and I start searching through the old backups, and I find a couple of instances of the file that were not the right one, because we already knew they weren't the right file size, and he said they were in a different location on the server. So I spent a good amount of time going through this and starting to sweat, thinking, why don't I have a copy of this, and what am I going to tell this guy? You know, I should have a backup. It's been running. There's been no logs of anything showing that the backup did not run. I'm starting to get a little worried. This is a pretty big client, and this was an important file. I'm like in the server area, not wanting to come out after a little while, because I'm like, I'm not sure how I'm going to tell them I can't find this file.
Hiding in
the server. I'm like, what We've do I do? So I finally, okay, I'm going to take a deep breath. I'm going to come out. And so I start talking him through it. I'm like trying to find out why this could be. And I'm asking him, is he sure that he placed the file in that location? And I can see he's getting a little bit concerned. I forget how he got to this point where he's, yeah, I moved it over here. I'm like, did you by chance put it this copy on your desktop? Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, and he's, can you look in your trash? And he goes, oh, there it is. And I'm like, oh, damn it. Never mind. Never mind. Yeah. Like, no big deal. I'm sweating, you know, I'm thinking, because he took the original copy that I did find on the server, dragged it over to his desktop, worked on it there, and then accidentally deleted it. It just goes to show you, I went for like a good portion of time just thinking, I'm not sure what's going to happen here, to being, oh, no big deal. Here it is.
Well, the painful thing too is what you're doing there, Sam, with the tape system, with the Brew and the carousel, is it takes so long for those tapes basically to load in, to drop in, and then you could start to scan through the data. Am I right?
Yeah, totally, man. Exactly.
I mean, it's just such a time suck. It's such a mechanical system, and you're just like waiting for the thing to index up, and then you've got to either rewind the tape or fast forward the tape, and it's during those clutch situations, you want to be able to get quick results. We're so spoiled these days by being able to just mount a drive and start to parse through all the nested folders to find recovered data.
Yeah, I mean, the catalog is a little bit faster and more efficient now, but that brings about some old bad memories of how I used to always have to do that and wait for it to switch to tape 2 and go looking on there, and that was just awful, awful experience.
Remember when you had to rewind your VHS tapes before you brought them back to the rental company?
Be kind, rewind.
So weird. It's such a weird concept.
And they used to sell specially built tape rewinders.
That's right. You know,
that was the thing. That's right.
I forgot about that.
Oh, my God.
That's amazing.
What's your business? Well, I make tape rewinders.
Right. Oh, man.
I went into a friend of mine's house years ago during the time when cordless remotes were in existence for a long period of time. And I walked into his living room, and there was this wire going from the TV box all the way to the couch and, you know, to this remote control. And it was just like so mind blowing to see that wire that had to be, it's hard to even fathom, you know. This is the one to explain to the kids. You know, in our day, we used to have a wire that used to go from this to the TV.
But you know what? The remote probably always worked, though. That's the thing, right? Yeah. Less to go wrong.
You could always find it, too. That's just true. Follow the wire.
Follow the wire, yeah.
Right. You never had to change batteries. Exactly. We have a client who's BreakFix. They're all Mac, probably about 7 Macs in the office, and they have 2 or 3 PCs, different ages.
One is a Windows 2003 running XP. You know, another one's a Windows 7, another one's a Windows 10. They do environmental work. They have some proprietary GPS software that they need to use on these Windows boxes, and that's why they still have it. Prior to me working with them, someone years ago had set them up with a Buffalo Link Station NAS. When I came in and came on board, they also had a Sonic Wall in place. So I've inherited the Sonic Wall, typical Windows stuff you would see. And they said they wanted to move all to Mac. And again, this goes like back 7 years. We got them a Promise Raid and a Mac Mini server, and everything's been great. As I come in to do the break fix work, once in a while, I'd go into the server room and I would see this Buffalo NAS hooked up and blinking away and not really think much of it. So I was on site working with the Promise Raid. I believe I did a firmware update on the Promise Raid and did some other work. And I think we upgraded the Mac Mini server to Sierra. And during the course of me working in the server room, I power cycled network switch that they had, an unmanaged switch. And that's the only thing I did that had any connectivity or connective tissue to this Buffalo NAS. I leave the client, you know, everything's good. Couple hours later, I get the phone call. We can't get to our mounted drive on our PCs that has all the geo data. So I'm like, okay, try this here. Let me log into the server. So I didn't see it on the server. I did an IP scan. I didn't see anything that manifested itself as a Buffalo Link Station, because I assume that's where the repository of it was. But again, it was an inherited piece of equipment. You know, I was kind of under the, because they were break fix, it was sort of like, don't ask, don't tell. And, you know, shame on me for not scratching my head one day and going into the owner's office and saying, what's the deal on this thing? You know, is there anything important on there? Or shouldn't we be backing this up? And it's a client that's grown over time, and we have a really good relationship, and the owner's a really great guy, just very easy to get along with, perfectly understanding of technology, and one of those rare guys that understands that technology can go wrong all the time, and that you're just lucky to have, you know, a working computer on most days. So they weren't that far down the road. They were about a half hour drive. So I hop in the car and I said, look, I've got to come out there and see what's going on with this Buffalo workstation. So I get in the car, show back up in the server room. Now, this product is a Buffalo Link Station Pro Duo 2-bay set up as a 1 terabyte. There's 2 500 gig drives in there. The product was released in 2004, and this was indeed where they were storing all their geo data that was loading into these PCs that I never really had any kind of hands-on with. It wasn't on the network anymore. So I called up Buffalo, and Buffalo has free tech support, which was pretty amazing. Got a case number, got a guy right away on the phone. The guy was extremely accommodating, really patient, took me through everything. And basically we did what basic troubleshooting that you could possibly do on this unit. There really wasn't much. There was just a reset button on the back and just some dim blinky lights on the front, and just being able to pull out the plug. This thing had failed. Either the drives had failed or the enclosure had failed. So
not good.
Yep.
Not good, because I was the last person to touch the ball, so to speak. Hmm. I said to the client, well, I'm not sure what's going on here. Let me pull the drives and see if I can take them back to my office and see if we can mount them. And because it was at the end of the day, it was like 5 or 6 o'clock. So let me get out of here, take them back to my office. So this Buffalo Link Station runs Linux. So the file system is UFS. So I think from Paragon, I got a free trial, like a 14-day trial on a UFS driver. So I mounted it on my MacBook Pro, and both drives mounted, but there was no, you couldn't see anything. So it didn't necessarily mean that the drives had lost the data. It just meant that it couldn't rebuild the RAID simply by mounting on the Apple desktop. So I fired up my copy of Windows 10, and then I banged around on the internet and found a program that could actually work with Linux-based RAIDs. At this point, this is way above my pay grade.
Yeah, yeah.
And the upshot of it was there is this company that makes a software product, and I think they're from Scandinavia, and they're called Reclaim Me. It's kind of a funny little URL, and we'll put it in the link notes. And they had a UFS navigator, and this navigator determined that the RAID was not a RAID 1, lucky me, but it was a RAID 0. Oh, man. You know, that means that both drives needed to be working for me to get the data back. It was able to scan through both drives, recognized it was RAID 0, and then they said, you could download this additional product, which will make it, it'll allow you to work with RAID 0 drives or RAID NASs, their Linux. And so I did that, put that product in their show notes, and it scanned through the entire drive overnight, found all the geo files, found just everything on the drive, and for $200. You know how it's kind of like ransomware with data recovery these days. So I paid for the license key. $200, it allowed me to recover all the data to one of my work drives. I was able to go back to the client site, put it as a wide open drive and plugged it into the Mac Mini server. And then the Windows PC was able to read the geo data off of it. It was pretty amazing.
That's awesome.
Oh, man. Were they psyched?
Yeah, I mean, but not as psyched as I was, you know. And they're like, oh, they're like, oh, Jerry, you know, we knew you could do it, you know.
Oh, really? Nice.
Well, kind of. Yeah, they're like, yeah, you know, we had faith in you. We knew you just had to just spend some time with the drives. We weren't worried. I mean, he understood this conversation with him. Marie understood. And I said, look, Dave, you know, I didn't touch this box. All I did was I power cycled the switch. And he goes, no. I understand these things happen. Well, the other thing was, for $80 on eBay, believe it or not, somebody had a working Buffalo 2004, an identical model. Mm-hmm. I got that shipped today. It arrived in my office. I took the two drives that I pulled out of the failed enclosure. I put them back in, careful to know which one was drive one and which one was drive two, plugged that in, and all their data mounted. So now they got a working Buffalo NAS again, and they have all the data recovered on the secondary drive.
That's crazy. Fortunate. Yeah, that is crazy. Yeah. I mean, thankfully it was the enclosure and not the actual drives. That's the big piece right there.
Exactly.
Yeah, very lucky. So they have a backup now, right?
Yeah, as soon as I plugged the backup drive into the Mac Mini server, yeah, I put it on the crash plan program.
Very nice. Wow, that is above and beyond, Jerry. That's I completely agree. It's above my pay grade as far as like recovering data from not only a NAS in RAID 0 based on Linux file system. I mean, it's just, that's pretty amazing though that they use an open standard like RAID format that you can actually mount, you know, using like a generic Linux installation or Mac or whatever, but with that file system accessible.
Yeah, they may not do that anymore, but again, I don't know if they've maintained the same open standards that they did back in 2004, but this LinkStation was definitely accessible. Yeah, and I've just marveled at this program that could look at both drives and figure it all out and put it back together. So
what was plan C? Was that like put the whole NAS in the fridge or in the freezer?
Exactly.
Just shove the whole thing into the, you know.
It would have worked, man.
Yeah.
Have you ever been in that situation where reviewing the client, probably where I could have done better as a consultant was I should have asked questions about this device that I really had no knowledge of, right? You know, but there was a lot of old equipment in that server closet, and I assumed that most of it was dark. And I thought that if I would have known about it, right, you know, in the years that we had been doing business, if there was anything else that was really an integral part of their organization, and this really was a very important cornerstone to them doing what they do for their surveying and for mapping out the territories that they're going to do their environmental work on. It was huge. It's like a big asset for them. But has that ever happened to you where you've been on site somewhere and you didn't really touch something, but you were near it and all of a sudden the thing just stopped working and they're looking at you and... I can't even count the
amount of times that's happened to me. No, I'm serious. It has happened to me on numerous occasions. There have been times when it's just basically like the network goes down, something like that. Just I happen to be in the office walking around. They're like, what'd you do? The network's down. I'm like, I didn't even touch anything yet. But they're looking at you because you're there.
Right. Yeah, just bad timing. I mean, I can't think of an example offhand, but that's exactly it. It's like, you know, wrong place, wrong time. They're obviously looking to you because you would be the one otherwise to, like, you know, take the network down. Or Jerry, you couldn't think of any reason why like what you did would have affected that box, you know, in this way. But of course, they don't make that connection necessarily. And luckily, this client was, you know, not one that would place any blame immediately. But another client might say, they're not even hearing you when you're like, well, all I did was like reboot the switch or something like that. It's not logical to them. They just think whatever you did screwed it. Like you would have been responsible for the data, you know, in those cases, right? Like if it was the wrong client that this happened to.
Exactly. I mean, I felt even though I didn't do this, I did, you know, somehow like, I was involved in it.
Right. You took responsibility. It wouldn't have been your fault, but like it would have been your responsibility from their perspective, you know, from another client's perspective. So. Yeah, I mean, you're lucky in the sense that you had them on your side. But it's funny because, like you said, they almost had too much faith in you that they weren't even impressed that you got the data back, you know?
Exactly. Oh, we knew you could do it.
Right.
I had been texting Sam earlier in the week. This is the same client, Sam, where we had been going back and forth about being able to save files and being able to read and write to files, working with different iterations of Microsoft Office on different versions of the Microsoft operating system. That's a real sticky wicket when you're trying to save a file and somebody's using Windows, using Office 2003, and then somebody's on Windows Office 2007, and somebody else is on 365, and those file permissions can be a real mess, especially saving to a Mac server.
And is this a client where you'd have a tough time saying you need to be on a level playing field in terms of versions and all that stuff?
Not too much. Yeah, no, they kind of get it, you know. And again, it's not that big an organization where it represents a sizable cost. I think you run into trouble sometimes when you have these big pool of computers and all of a sudden what you're dangling in front of them is this large bill from Microsoft that they have to all of a sudden pony up and get everybody up to speed with the latest version of Office 365. And sometimes you could do that and you still have file permissions problems. And they're like, well, we spent all this money and we're still having problems. You know, how come you didn't fix it?
Yeah, and it's like that's where you need to start, you know, before you can even begin to troubleshoot. I mean, it's silly to put the level of effort that it would take to get all those different versions spanning a decade or more in that case to talk to each other. I mean, I would almost just say like, well, you're already overdue to upgrade. I won't even troubleshoot this until we're on a level playing field. And maybe that's just going to solve it. You know, it's more like that, like spinning it like, you need to do this anyway. And if you do, this might also solve this problem. And if it doesn't, at least we can troubleshoot, you know, it's just insane.
Eliminate some of the variables.
Yeah, exactly. Forget it. Otherwise it's not supportable. I'm just thinking back to putting it in the freezer. I had a client suggest that she had spilled liquid water or something on her MacBook Pro. And it turned out to be a like pretty significant damage. It like got into the display and the display was like all discolored. It needed a new DC inboard. It wouldn't charge. So I'm telling her, you know, with a liquid spill, you've got to like basically shut it down, let it dry out, you know, using a little bit of heat, or sometimes you tell people about rice. And we're saying, you know, we have this waiting period of at least like 48 hours. And she said, if I put it in the freezer, does that help? And I was like, what? I'm like trying to think.
Ooh. It'll freeze the water in it.
Right. I was like, that's a terrible idea. Like put your MacBook in the freezer. It's like the worst thing. You laughed and said, no, that that's not something you want to do. And but now I just realized that's why she's thinking of the hard drive issue, I guess. I mean, I don't know where
she probably Googled it, from. You know, yeah, and exactly. Came up with that.
I was thinking somebody was like messing with her, you know, so I put it in the freezer.
My daughter actually spilled water on her MacBook Air the other day. She caught it quickly, right? And then it was right on the keyboard area, left side. And then we kind of turned it on side and just water just came pouring out the side.
Ooh, yikes.
So, yeah, but I took it apart. I aired it out. I actually did put a little bit of heat on there with all I had was a blow dryer. Mm-hmm. It ended up fine. I mean, like I let it dry out for, it wasn't quite 48 hours, probably like a day and a half. After it aired out, I put it back together and it's been operating fine. I think she caught it quickly enough and I didn't see any obvious damage to any in of the internal guts. But I was like, oh man, what am I going to do here? In our family, at least, we don't buy the kids new laptops. They get a hand-me-down from whatever. So I'm like, I don't want to buy another one for the kid, you know?
Right.
But we were fortunate. We were okay.
So I have a great recommendation on just that topic, Sam. Did you guys notice that AppleCare is now AppleCare Plus for the Mac? I noticed this when I was speccing a new MacBook Pro for a client. And I always go through the steps and kind of give them the recommendation on the different specs and stuff like that. And I say, okay, add to cart, you know, on the next page, select AppleCare. And I double check the price. And I'm looking at the price for AppleCare on the MacBook Pro that I'm speccing out. It's a 13-inch MacBook Pro. And I see it's priced at $269. Then I noticed the plus in the name, AppleCare Plus, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, could that be? And sure enough, Apple has added accidental damage coverage to AppleCare, and they're now calling it AppleCare Plus to be consistent with the AppleCare Plus branding for, you know, iPhone and iPad. What a great option. So it covers accidental damage of your Mac, MacBook Pro, iMac, Mac Mini, Mac Pro. I'm not sure if the price has even gone up. Like in the case of, it went up like a few bucks for the MacBook Pro 13-inch. So it used to be like, I think $249. Now it's $269. And then it's like on the 15-inch MacBook Pro, it's $379. That's, I think, maybe $30 more expensive than it was before. Didn't go up that much in price, but that that is like really the only hole in AppleCare coverage compared to the prior plans. The prior plans covered things like just won't turn on, we don't know why, and it's not liquid spill and it hasn't been dropped. There were those exceptions. Now it covers basically everything. If you crack the display, they're going to cover it. So that's really impressive to me. To the point of the iMac, it's $169 for the iMac. I think that was the price it was before. Doesn't that sound right to you guys? Do you remember?
That does sound right to me, Joe.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was right around that price, which is a really good deal. I mean, when you look at an iMac, although I don't think spilling liquid on an iMac is that big of a concern, but certainly bumped or dropped or something, even in transport, it's a great option. So I was just really excited to see that. And that makes selling AppleCare a complete no-brainer in my experience.
Yeah, I mean, at that point, why wouldn't you get it, right? I mean, the cost there, especially on the iMac being $169, and as far as we can remember, the price hasn't changed, that's a no-brainer. You have, like, just do it. The other pieces of just, not even just accidental damage, but not being able to get into the devices as easily now is big case for using AppleCare Plus.
Of course, there is a caveat there where it's only two incidents. So you can't, your kid can't keep on smashing his MacBook and they'll keep on fixing it. So it's two, like I think it is with the phone for the Plus coverage. That's huge for the amount of people that I've dealt with firsthand that have done accidental water spills. What I love too is when you get that phone call and they say, well, it was only a little bit, but my W key, my K key, right. Space bar doesn't work anymore.
And they're listing.
Do you think they'll start working again?
Right. Right. Well, which key was that? Oh, the W? No, that's never cut. No.
Oh,
the
yeah, which key?
The K key, you have a really good chance of getting that back.
Exactly. Right. Right.
Just dry it out a little more.
You know, they're hoping they just want you to like reassure them or something like that. It wasn't that much liquid. It's like, well, you know, it's liquid and it's electronics and it's probably not going to work. You want to set the expectation. It's probably not coming back to life, but maybe you'll get lucky.
Just put it in the freezer.
Yeah, put it in the freezer and hope for the best and call me tomorrow. And just to be clear, as you mentioned, Jerry, you know, up to two incidents of accidental damage coverage. I don't think the other hardware issues are limited to like a number of incidents. It's just the accidental damage that's limited to two incidents. And it's a service fee of $99 for screen damage or external enclosure damage, or $299 for other types of damage. I think that probably covers like what Apple would call abuse, you know, including liquid spills and stuff like that. There is a per incident charge, but it's way less than what it would have been before. The other, you know, thing, it was kind of a gray area before. Like if you had AppleCare and you had some damage and you're like really nice to Apple and you haven't had any other issues, like sometimes they would make an exception or charge you less, you know, than like the repair would otherwise cost. I've seen clients get special treatment like that. In other words, they would pay something for a repair, but it wouldn't have been as much as it would have been like if they hadn't had AppleCare, you know, even if it was their fault for breaking the screen or whatever. But this just makes it very clear. It's like, you know, you pay a little bit more upfront and then you have this peace of mind that if you break your screen, it's only $99 and it's, you know, it's limited to that. It's not going to cost you, you know, $500 or more in those cases. So I think it's a great option to have and it's a no-brainer to sell to clients.
So this is where the rubber meets the road. Joe, are you going to buy AppleCare Plus for your MacBook Pro late 2016?
I think I already bought AppleCare. So that's a little bit of a concern that they weren't offering AppleCare Plus when I bought this, you know, just what, 6 months ago or something like that, or 8 months ago. I would, if I were buying the machine again today, I think I would buy AppleCare Plus.
Yeah, there's definitely a built-in value there for the extra $100, I guess it would be, between the two.
Well, not even like in the 13 inch, I think it's like $20 more upfront. And then, you know, of course you pay per incident, but I mean, it's a great privilege to have to be able to pay, you know, $100 to get the screen replaced if needed or whatever.
Yeah. That's ridiculously cheap.
Sam, you mentioned like can't open these up anymore. As that happens more, you know, as we go further down the line here, like I think the new MacBook Pro has, I want to say the SSD is soldered in now. You know, it used to be, of course, it was modular. It's like, you know, Apple would never in a million years authorize you to replace your own SSD or whatever, but it was like doable in theory. But now I think it's just actually soldered into the logic board. So these things are getting less and less repairable, let's say. So if I broke my screen, sure, I might save a few bucks versus like having a repair company do it. We could do it internally. I wouldn't want to, though. I'd rather, you know, I gladly would pay Apple $100 to do that. So it's just a great option to have.
Since we're talking about these MacBooks, I know it's been the show policy to not get too topical on product releases unless it's very specific, but with the release or the refresh of the MacBook Pro line, all the reports basically stating that the Kaby Lakes do seem to be 20% faster. Do you feel any buyer's remorse? Because we all bought late 2016 MacBook Pros.
Yeah, I mean, I've considered would I sell this and, you know, eat a little bit of, you know, just the depreciation cost on it and then buy a new one? Is it worth that effort? I don't know. Also, there is a benefit to the Rev 2. I think in a lot of cases, I've seen weird touch bar issues and unexplainable like slowness in some cases. You know, sometimes it'll be like overheating in my bag. It's like it never went to sleep or it woke up or something like that. So I've seen weird issues that I can only explain, you know, only sort of chalk up to it being like a Rev 1. So I also think there's some value in like upgrading to a Rev 2 of this new form factor. I'm not sure if I'll do that or wait to the next one. But yeah, it is tempting to get the latest and greatest, of course.
I'll probably wait some time. It does aggravate me at times, like Joe said. I do have some issues. I had this issue that I texted you guys about earlier today with just an aggravation of every single time I make a network change, whether that be from wired to wireless or connecting to a VPN. It's just this horrific delay. And today I was working on upgrading a network, making changes to the switches and putting in new Wi-Fi. So every time I had to go test something, I'm waiting for the beach ball. And I'm like, I wanted to chuck my computer. Joe, you mentioned that it sometimes happens when you connect via VPN. I haven't researched to see if other people are having this issue and whether I should consider it software or hardware related at this point. But I'm aggravated enough at times where I'm like, all right, maybe I'll take that 20% bump.
Yeah. And when you're jumping back and forth, are you doing this on Wi-Fi or you actually have an Ethernet adapter?
It can be either way. Like I could be going from Wi-Fi and then I plug in my USB-C Ethernet adapter and then I have to wait like a good 30, 45 seconds while the beach ball goes. If I attempt to go to system preferences, it sometimes will not even show. It will only show my VPN connections and not my Wi-Fi or Ethernet connection, and it'll just spin and hang. And then finally it'll show up again. And I'm like, this is incredibly aggravating.
Yeah, that's definitely not happening on my system at all. And We have somewhat of a similar setup and I'm on VPNs back and forth all the time. Are you running any antivirus at all?
No, I am not.
That actually reminded me of something I have seen on my machine pretty consistently, which is the Wi-Fi indicator in the menu bar in the top right is like often out of sync with reality. It's showing that it's connected when I know it's not, you know, and then I'll click on it and it'll be like, oh yeah, no, I'm not connected. That's right. You know, and like updates to the icon showing the empty signal bars. I'm trying to remember another example, but it's usually that. It's like I was connected when I put my machine to sleep and then I wake it up and everything else is like responsive and seems to be updating. But then that one icon is not updated for whatever reason. And then I click on it.
A little late to the party.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's like, oh, no, now I'm connecting. Okay, now I'm connected. And it's only after you click on it do you see what's actually happening in reality.
Yeah, I've seen that where it's a little bit logy, to catch up. Definitely where I've seen it more where I connect and it doesn't show that I'm connected yet, but yet I'm able to pull down information, you know, via a browser or something.
But I wonder
like
if that's just a Sierra thing, do you think? I think so.
Yeah, I don't think it's hardware.
Right, yeah. But, and the same thing happens to my time as well on occasion.
And we mentioned this before on the show, Sam, but I would just for free, you know, it'd be worth it for giggles to do this. There's that little utility called Etrecheck. So it's Etrecheck. It'll look at all the startup inits and just make sure that, you know, you got something in there that's not real legacy that might be causing a little bit of interference.
I'd actually be willing to look at that. But as we joked many months ago, I did my completely fresh install on this new computer, which Joe thinks is a waste of time. And now maybe he's right because I've got all these issues. But I shouldn't have anything too legacy, too old. But I'm willing to check it out, of course. I mean, and it does seem intriguing to try that anyway.
Now I remember you were telling us how cool you were and how smart and how we should do this.
That goes without saying. Come on.
Yeah.
I have seen intermittent like slowness in mail where like I remember I complained originally about like mail was like really slow and I'd like click an email and it was 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds, and then it loads and it's just, you know, it's like way slower than it should be. I saw that happening again, and then there was a Mail Acton update, and then I did that, and then it's been better. You know, some of these things I think are software, at least on my side, but then again, I feel like there's something about this machine that's not quite as stable hardware, you know, hardware-wise as past Macs, and I wonder if it's been, you know, if it's more stable in Rev 2, or if we need to wait a little bit longer for the next gen.
Well, you know, the thing that surprised me about this refresh, it's clear they're still using the same logic boards, even though it's Kaby Lake, because the RAM didn't increase, the RAM restrictions. I think if we were able to put more RAM into these Macs beyond the 16, I think I would really seriously consider ditching this and getting the refresh. But I'm comfortable to hang in there a little bit longer and wait for whatever happens next. The rumor mill says that, for instance, the MagSafe adapter is coming back.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that. Okay. I don't know if I need that so much, but...
Yeah, then we couldn't daisy chain our power cables, Jerry.
That's right. Can't believe you guys tested that live. That was pretty impressive.
That's awesome.
The fact that it worked was pretty awesome, yeah. But I'm surprised, Jerry, you're saying you would upgrade if they could stuff more RAM in there. But didn't you get the one with 8 gigs of RAM and you kind of said, no, who would ever buy the 16? And you were making fun of me for getting the 1 terabyte and all that stuff.
Yeah, I got the 16 and I think you were busting my chops, man. What gives?
I did. I'm running Commando on this machine with my 8 gigs of RAM. So lean and mean. Keep it real with the 8 gigs of RAM.
Yeah. I mean, it would be nice, like, if you had to run a virtual machine in there to do data recovery or whatever.
If you had Linux NAS in RAID 0 and you had to recover data off of it all night.
For example.
Might do better with a little bit more RAM. I think you're right. Installation of Windows 10 was suffering a little bit on the allocation of 4 gigs of RAM to do that task. Sure. But it performed marvelously.
Did you guys hear that AFP is deprecated in the new APFS filing system?
Oh, I thought it already was deprecated.
No, currently, no. I mean, you can use AFP.
Well, no, deprecated meaning it's like, discouraged, basically. So are you saying it's like not even supported? Is that the idea?
Correct.
Ah, okay. So I think deprecated means that it's still supported, but like it won't be the next generation, basically.
So what are you saying? Well, Sam's misusing the word?
Yes, I am saying.
Well, hang on. So from developer.apple.com, you cannot share APFS formatted volumes using AFP. The AFP protocol is deprecated.
Gotcha. Okay.
Boom.
So straight from them. All right. But I'm pretty sure they read that previously, though, that it was deprecated previously.
As did I. I believe I've seen that word associated with AFP in the past.
Whatever, you guys.
So this it's like deprecated squared now.
Yeah, no, now it's really
it's really deprecated. Yeah.
No backsies.
It's depreciated.
Yeah.
Oh, it's man. Double dog deprecated.
Double secret depreciated.
Oh man. So keep recording or switch
Where's
gears and keep
Flick?
Recording.
What? Where's huh? Flick? Never mind.
Flick. Oh, I don't get the reference.
What?
That was the double dog. That was the Gene Shepherd, the Christmas story, where the teacher goes, "Where's Flick?" And he's got his tongue stuck to the pole.
Yeah.
That's how they got into the thing. I double dog dare you to put your tongue in the pole. Right?
Now I get your reference.
Yeah, I was taking a quote from Animal House saying double secret, that when they go on double secret probation.
Oh, and I was doing the Christmas story.
I just was going along with what you guys were doing.
Jerry, we're usually on the same wavelength with movie quotes.
I know. That movie has become such a fixture in our household.
My sister has the leg lamp.
Does she really?
Yeah.
Awesome. It's Italian. It says on the box, fragile.